Welcome to Uncle Form Podcast. This is a 30-ish minute podcast created by Darius Watkins and Ryan Thomas. We are two black males discussing the intersections between faith and culture. So join us on this ride while we chop it up for the next 30-ish minutes. Man, what's up, y'all? Welcome to Uncle Form Podcast, man. I know that we just had our season finale last week, but like something's come up and you really don't have a choice but to talk about it. So I did want to have this conversation. And I think that generally speaking, when stuff like this happens, speaking of Tyre Nichols, like when things like this happen, like we usually try to give it a minute. We usually like try to not make it look like we're trying to capitalize on anything like that. So like in this case, you know, I was like, talk to Ryan, who's not here today. But I was like, you know what, let's just have this conversation. And let's have this conversation with like some dope black men from Memphis or who are currently in Memphis and got a lot of boots on the ground, put a lot of work in Memphis. So I have the Avengers with me today. I'm just Hawkeye in this piece today. So I ain't got all that, but I do got the direction of the bow and arrow. So I'm going to try to do my thing as well. But with that being said, man, we're just going to have this conversation and really just like create a space to be able to, one, just like process things, and two, just have conversations about where things are, implications, and where things may be leading in these areas. So, and usually it's a 30-minute episode. This episode is going to be about an hour. So I'm letting you know that off the rip. And also, this may be an episode that you may want to watch on YouTube because you may get some voices confused and stuff like that. For people who normally listen to on the podcast, you may want to watch this one on YouTube. So I'm going to let my people introduce themselves.
Yeah, thank you, Darius. Hey, guys, I'm Dr. Justin Dotson. I'm a licensed therapist for the state of Tennessee. I work with adult males. I'm also author of a book called Navigating Your Courage, The Courage of a Single Freckle. And I am a suicide prevention trainer as well. So I train organizations about how to recognize suicidal ideation within members of the community. And I'm also a counselor educator for the University of Memphis.
Yeah. And Dr. Dyson was on episode 46, 27, and 14. So this is episode 101, just context. So he was on all three of those episodes. So he's a day one. Brennan.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Congratulations on 100 episodes, by the way.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, but yeah, my name is Brennan Steele. I am an educator and author of the book Breathe, A Guided Healing Journal for Black Men. And as a part of that, I founded the Breathe Brother Movement, promoting healing and wholeness for Black men. I'm also a student at University of Memphis to become a therapist. I'm getting my master's in clinical mental health counseling.
Yeah, Brennan was actually on episode 73. So he has also been on a pod before, and Breathe Brother is a movement. I'm wearing a hoodie. He's wearing the hoodie, and this was not planned. Dr. McKinney.
What's up, y'all? Charles McKinney. I'm an associate professor of history and director of Africana Studies at Rhodes College. My areas of expertise, I study Black politics, and in particular, the civil rights and Black power areas. Those moments in history. And my perpetual and perennial question is, how do we get and stay free?
So y'all heard that. We probably not going to fully answer that today. But with that being said, man, Dr. McKinney has not been on a podcast before. So it's super dope to have him on the pod, man. It really is. And one thing that he didn't mention is that he is a dope father. I get the privilege to know both of his sons. I actually chopped it up with both of his sons during separate times during winter break. And they are two really, really great young men who are going to do a lot of great things. So it's really cool to see you doing everything that you're doing. But like, I know you more so as a father than like all the other things you listed. So like, that's really cool to see. We actually got another dope guest who just popped in, literally just at this moment popped in. My guy, Bartholomew Jones, also Maurice Henderson, also Mr. Coffee Black, also the GOAT. So to speak. Bart, what's good, man?
Yeah, my name is Bartholomew, educator, MC. I'm a coffee nerd. Me and my wife started this movement a couple years ago, wanted to reclaim the Black history of coffee and use coffee as like a basis to talk about Black histories and Black futures. So yeah, we do that. We do those things, use a lot of avenues to do that. Born and bred in Memphis, father of three. You probably gonna see my kids. I'm in their room right now because it's the quietest place in the house. So you know, yep. Husband, you know what I mean? Follower of the Most High since I was maybe 3. So, you know, excited to be chopping it up with you all today.
We're here now. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We're here now. And I just want to do like a quick timeline of everything that's gone down from January 7th to today. Today is January 30th. A lot has happened since then. 23 days, and this is the timeline. January 7th, we had the traffic stop where Tyree Nichols is beaten, and he dies on January 10th. And they say it's from a use of force incident with officers, which kind of like leads to language as to like who was at fault. January 15th, the police provide an update on the investigation. Just kind of say that, like, you know, essentially that from there, they've seen the video and now they got to like follow proper protocol, essentially. January 18th, a federal investigation is declared. January 20th, officers were named and fired. I think it's important to mention on January 20th, that was a Friday. And I think the announcement was about 6:30 at night. So like y'all know how the phrase go, like good news at the beginning of the week, bad news at the end of the week. And hopefully in the 24-hour news cycle, it just kind of gets through the weekend. And that's pretty much like the expectation there. So that's January 20th. And I'm going to go back there in a second. January 23rd, that was a Monday. The family views the police video. January 26th, the officers were charged. That's a Thursday. January 27th, the video footage was released. And it was released on, again, a Friday at around the same time, I think, roughly 6:00 p.m. was when it was viewed. And then the video is released and everything changes. The narrative changes, all the stuff changes as far as who's at fault. And then you see people basically batting cleanup. On January 28th, which was that Saturday, 2 sheriff county deputies were placed on leave. On January 28th, the Scorpion unit, which was the unit that was responsible for basically following him in an unmarked car, was disbanded. On January 30th, which is actually today at 11 a.m., Preston Hemphill, who was a white officer, was placed on leave. They declined to say if he was placed on paid leave or not, but they did say that he was placed on leave. Also, on January 30th at 5:30, three MFD firefighters were placed on leave, as well as at 8:00, 2 medical techs and 1 fire personnel person was fired. So, all that happened in the span of 23 days. I think before we can even have this conversation, like, we have to ask, like, the real question, like, of everybody who's here, did you watch the video? Like, did you choose to watch the video? And if so, why? If not, why not? We'll start with Bart.
I chose to partially watch it. I wasn't going to. And we got a phone call from a news outlet that kind of wanted us to comment on it. And so I felt like in order to comment in any type of way that was informative, I had to see some of the video. I couldn't make it through very much of it. I listened to like the audio toward the end and then tried to fill in the gaps with reading and talking to other people who did watch it. So yeah, watched the full thing.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know anybody who's watched the full video. A lot of folks I know pulled out like right toward the end because it just got bad, man. So
yeah, Brennan,
I chose not to watch it. The video of George Floyd took a lot from me, and I was like, I'm not doing this again. So yeah,
Justin.
Yeah, I've not watched the video. My why is that I haven't had the capacity yet. So no, I have not watched it yet.
Dr. McKinney.
I watched it, and I encourage others not to watch it. I think that, you know, the reason I watched it was because I knew I was going to be asked, just in my capacity as a historian and, you know, so on and so forth. I knew I was going to be asked by outlets about the video in particular, right? About what we saw, about what happened to this brother. So, So I watched it so that I could bear specific witness, not just witness, because I think everybody can bear witness, because this is not new, right? You know, right. This is not a new phenomenon. But I needed to be able to bear specific witness to what we saw, and not just of the actual violence, right? But mm-hmm. but the other sort of context that we see, the other things that we learn from the video, right? You know, mm-hmm. So yeah, I watched it.
Yeah, and I think for me, like, I didn't want to watch it, but I felt like, and I didn't watch the whole video in its entirety. But I felt like, as a citizen of Memphis, as somebody who represents Memphis frequently, as somebody who like has like a lot of reach like outside of the city and whatnot, like I felt like I at least had built up the capacity to watch that. And when I say that, what I mean is that like I never watched the full George Floyd video. I've never watched like over 1 minute of the George Floyd video. I had like since removed myself from watching these videos just because I knew it wasn't good for my mental health, for me personally. And like I'm somebody who grew up like in the Delta part of Arkansas and also Mississippi. So like I've been exposed to a lot. Like I saw Rosewood when I was like 7. So like I've been exposed to like a lot already, and I continue to be exposed to it. So like I felt like when I already knew the conclusion, like I didn't need to watch the video in its entirety, nor did I need to a lot of videos. But like the reason why I asked that question is because I think that like a lot of men and a lot of people place this duty on themselves to like watch stuff like this when they don't have to. It's not even like, it may not even be good for your mental health to watch it at this time. You may not even be in a mental space to be able to watch it at this time. So I think that's important. And, you know, I'm a school counselor, and like that Friday I talked to my 8th graders and I was like, hey, don't watch the video. Like y'all kids who've been basically around, like y'all are COVID kids essentially. So you spent like 2 years online watching God knows what. Right. So like in just having that conversation with them, just letting them know that like I didn't think everybody needs to watch it. But I think that we create this expectation that like that needs to happen. So like I want to get that out the way first. Mm-hmm. Now my next question is, and you know, everybody can answer it. If you don't want to, you don't have to. But how did y'all feel when you found out the officers were Black? Obviously you found this out, or the majority of the officers were Black. How'd you feel?
It's disappointing. It's disappointing. And it's hurtful, and to some degree you probably saw a familiar face, which I think adds another layer of disappointment. So it, you know, for me, it's more than a race issue. It's also a structural issue. It's also a policy issue. And so the more you look at this, the more it becomes real. And even thinking back to Trayvon Martin, it's still at a distance. And then you have George Floyd, and now you have Tyre Nichols, which now it's at home. And so I think that with time, it's gotten closer to home. And then you have this race car that looks different with this situation. And so the word that I would use to sum up is disappointing. Yeah, that's the way that I have processed it.
I was just going to say, I would echo Dr. Dotson's point. You know, it's disappointing, but you know, at the end of the day, you know, my critique of, and I think a number of people's critique of policing, right, is that this is a structural problem. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you hope that, you know, you would like to think that, you know, that putting Black men or Black women, Black people, you know, on police forces would in some way, shape or form mitigate, you know, the bad stuff. But we know that's just not true. Right. You know, when Michael Slager shot the brother in the back in South Carolina, the second cop on the scene to help him clean up the scenario so that his story, so he could get his story straight, was a brother. Right. You know, this sister up in Buffalo, New York, who got fired for stopping her partner from beating on a Black man, and he was white. She got fired by a Black police chief. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think it's real. I was disappointed. But at the end of the day, I think it's really important. From my perspective, at least, to remember, right, that, you know, that our problems with policing are structural. And, you know, in the color of people's skin, while we would like to think that would make a course correction, you know, while we would like to hope that people would make a course correction, that frequently is just not the case.
Mm.
I can't say how I feel. I don't think I've processed how I feel yet. I can say what I think.
Yeah.
I think that white supremacy has always required black participation. And so it's not surprising. And in a lot of ways, it's dependent on black innovation. There's almost like a weird kind of sick creativity. You know what I mean? And watching what I did watch of the video, like they were finding new ways to make this brother feel less than human and to really make that sentiment undeniably clear. And within that, I think that that is unfortunately very normal in how white supremacy moves, whether we're talking about on the African continent or anywhere else around the world. Like the majority of melanated people who are experiencing oppression experience the most direct form of that oppression at this point in history from people who look just like them. You know, most of the African tyrants and despots were black. You know what I mean? When we look at the Rwandan genocide, it was black people killing black people. And I think if you're in a majority black city like Memphis, 68%, 69%, 67% black, you're going to see that that continues. And my time in the public school system affirmed that. My biggest detractors from any kind of like revolutionary work that needed to happen in the community or with our students were always other black educators or administrators. You know what I mean? And I can understand that because you feel like you have to provide for your family and you feel like, well, if I don't participate in this system, and I guess they say, you know, our parents told us to be twice as good. So I guess if I'm not twice as good at oppressing black people in this system, then I won't be able to take care of my own family. And I can in some way understand that. I just can't condone it. But yeah, man, I don't think I know how it feels. It's been easier, honestly, to analyze it than to just sit and sit with the actual emotions around it.
Yeah, I think I can basically echo what everyone's saying. I think there was sadness, disappointment. And then I think there's like, especially when it first found out, like this similar to what Bart's saying, it's just like a resistance to actually like sitting in how I feel about it and more analyzing it. I think the additional thing that I'll add is I could also find myself kind of like bracing internally, I guess, for the ways in which I would have to or would be expected to respond to it. I think whenever these types of things happen, especially type of work that we all do, like there's an expectation that we respond. And it's like, how is it impacting black men, black people, et cetera. But I think the additional layer of it being like black cops, like makes it like an additional level of energy that you have to put toward, like you or be expected to put towards it. Like explaining like, how does this hold up with white supremacy? Or how does this explain the issue that there is, even because most people don't have the nuance of understanding that we've even described on this podcast so far. And so I think that like, I was more like bracing that, especially like I go to a multi-ethnic church. Like there's other like spaces that I am a part of where there are majority white people. And there's like this, like, I was just like, okay, what am I going to have to be ready for, either to not respond to and like come off as rude or whatever, or like decide to actually engage.
Yeah, and I think for me, like, you know, it's something that I don't want to say was expected, but it's something that is not a surprise. And when I say that, like, I mean, like, this is like, even going back to days of slavery, like, you can think about like how black people, how certain black people act towards others and whatnot. And I'm sure Dr. McKinney could talk about that for days. But with that being said, like, we could just go to the 90s and like look at Ice Cube's lyrics from F the Police, right? Like what is it he says? Let me find it real quick. What he says is like, don't let it be a black and a white cop, because that'll slam you down on the street top. Black cop showing out for the white cop. So like this is something that like, it's embedded into the DNA of our country, like almost. So like, to some degree, it was expected. Still disappointing, but like expected, and you know, unfortunate that like that's what happened. Now, while we're talking about Black Cops, and maybe two people respond to this. What were y'all's reaction when you saw how swiftly they were relieved of their duties and charged and arrested and all that good stuff?
I think initially I was glad to see that there was a swift response. I think I was relieved because it kind of took away that initial feeling of powerlessness that I remember having surrounding pretty much every other case, not being able to affect that. And mm-hmm. so it made me feel glad. The more that, like, we had some people over at the coffee shop yesterday, we opened up just for our community to come talk mm-hmm. to us. And after that discussion, I remember leaving and feeling angry because it almost feels like what initially I thought was like, man, a sincere willingness to like pursue justice now feels like almost like a misdirection. And this kind of gets into a lot of the fear mongering that was put out preceding to and during and after the release of the video. But in a lot of ways, I feel like it was almost, they were like lambs to the slaughter. Not that they're lambs in any sense of the word, but that they were almost a sacrifice to like obfuscate the actual conversation surrounding the corruption and the reality of what life is like in Memphis for poor people. And because they immediately dispelled these officers, it almost feels like they're ending the conversation surrounding the issues that made officers like this possible. And those are issues and situations that I think anybody who spent any amount of time in Memphis is like nauseatingly familiar with. And that's the conversation that I think they're trying to avoid. Because if people poke just a little bit at what's happening behind the scenes here in this city, it's going to expose a lot of politicians. It's going to expose a lot of elected officials. And I think people are trying to avoid that by trying to end the conversation before people have a chance to really say how they feel.
Yeah. Dr. McKinney, can you kind of like talk a little bit more about that, or just kind of like elaborate a little bit more on what he's saying?
Well, I think none of this stuff, I think we always have to be thinking about complexity and nuance, right? And the way white supremacy works, and that, you know, white supremacy doesn't ever get put on, it never gets put on pause, right? You know, white supremacy doesn't take a summer vacation, right? It doesn't stop for Hanukkah or Christmas, right? Or Black History Month, right? You know, it's always there, right? So, you know, I think that's a conversation we certainly are going to need to have, right? About, you know, about the speed with which these five Black cops got fired, charged, and arrested. Mm-hmm. You know, because I think we, you know, and we're hearing today, I think one, we found out that we found the name of a white cop today. Right. Mm-hmm. Who is, you know, who I'm hearing, and I, you know, y'all can correct me if I'm wrong, was on the scene, actually participated mm-hmm. in the violence. I think he mm-hmm. with pepper spray or a taser, but he hadn't been fired yet. Right. He's just on leave. So, you know, I got yo tango questions. Right.
And what kind of leave?
Right, exactly. Was it paid or unpaid? Right, you know. So did he get? You know, he's still getting paid to murder this brother. So we're not at the end of the story yet, right? In terms of, you know, and that's not even thinking about, you know, I don't think the sheriff's office is done. I don't think the fire department is done, right? You know, I think mm-hmm. you know, at the end of the day, we're just at the beginning of this, right? So I think we have a whole lot. We have a whole lot more to see unwind, but yeah, I share Brother Jones's view that, you know, that this was, it was, it's you know, it's like Transformers, more than meets the eye, right? There's a little something else going on here, right? And so so we need to see how it's gonna play out, but you know. We're not being paranoid when we start to make these sorts of observations, right? We're not being, we're not playing the race card. We're not, you know, we're not engaged in, baseless speculation. I'm thinking about that. Thinking about that black cop who shot the white woman. You know, and they, you know, and he got convicted, right? You know, they wrapped him up. They gift wrapped him to go to federal, you know, to go to prison with the quickness, mm-hmm. right? So you know, so we know and understand how these dynamics play out, and we know how things shift and move when you know, when black victims, depending on the race of the victim, depending on the race of the cops, depending on the, you know, the race and inclinations of the DA, right? You know, I think, you know, if our previous DA had been had still been in office, I think it's an open question as to whether or not anybody at this point would have been convicted of anything, right? Because the previous DA bent over backwards to defend cops. Mm-hmm. You know, as dirty as she was, she had no problem with dirty cops either, right? So,
right.
We're with cops who, you know, who had clearly violated the law, right? So, I think there's a lot of moving parts to this, mm-hmm. And we've got a lot of ground we still need to cover. But race always matters, right? And white supremacy is always laying at the heart of these sorts of moments.
Yeah, that's good. And I think that, like, it's important to, like, I know that we have a wide range of audience. Like, we've been listening to this podcast, been listened to in 45 out of 50 states in the country. So, like, I know that, like, this is episode 101, but this is not a 101 course that's going on right now. Like, so I know that, like, it may be some things that, like, that y'all are hearing. It may be, like, you want more, no pun intended, black and white answers. But, like, it's when you live in this space, when you truly know this space, like, it's more gray. And you just got to be willing to accept that and know that, like, it's going to be nuanced. Most people on this call did not watch the video, but we know what we know what happened well before watching the video, just because of the history behind it. So, like, we do want to, like, mention it and talk about that. I do want to shift a little bit and just talk about kind of like the coverage and kind of like the preemptive motives or preemptive judgment decisions that were made by a lot of people in the city, whether it be shutting all school events down for a weekend or shutting down restaurants, so on and so forth. Just kind of anticipating violence. And with that, I want to lead this to Justin and Brennan, because I know y'all really didn't get a chance to talk last time. So, like, how did y'all feel? Like, did y'all feel like this was, like, when they shut all these things down, did you feel like it was adding anything positive to the city, like, in shutting these things down, in shutting down school events, in shutting down pretty much all after school activities for Friday, as if it's an album drop? Like, how did y'all feel about that?
You know, I see it from both perspectives. I think on one hand, and I've said this before, we've had this tragedy happen and the city is trying to figure out what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And just like Dr. McKinney said, this isn't the end of the story. And so as mm-hmm. we're going day by day, you're trying to process what is happening and people are trying to figure out what to do with it. And so I think people in authority trying to be proactive, take the steps that they believe is necessary at the time, even mm-hmm. if it may not make sense to other people. On the other hand, why not continue with having consistency and not changing the schedule for children and making sure that things run as normal while also educating them on this is what's happening in our city, this is what's happening around you. Mm-hmm. But we're going to keep going as normal because I don't want your schedule to be interrupted. So on one hand, I understand the importance of getting ahead of things. And then on the other hand, it almost feels like Memphis weather where we work ourselves up and then, you know, the city chose to respond in a different way. And so I appreciate that because we are continuing to figure out what we want to do with this. So I try to see things from multiple perspectives. But I am glad that I think it's helped that the officers were charged and some type of accountability was shown to us. I think that gave us a little bit more rest and assurance, even though we know it's still not the full and complete story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think Justin, soon you said Memphis weather, I was like thinking the same exact thing when all of it happened. But I think that, I think I was kind of feeling away a little bit because I think I was like this expectation that like Memphians were going to be like wild and violent. And I think that just kind of feeds into the same narrative of like this whole incident in the beginning, in this first place. And so I think that like, I didn't necessarily know why it was like so much fear around it. And I think additionally, I was feeling a fear, not just like, I felt like the fear from like white Memphians more so than anybody, to be honest, in the circles that I was in at the time. And so I just was like, y'all, like, we know that, like, I feel like that people, like, similar to what was said, I think we know that, like, the police officers were already charged. And so I think that did give a little bit more of that, like, okay, like, at least there's some type of accountability. But also, like, there's a right to protest. And, like, I think Memphians show that we can protest peacefully. And so I think that, I didn't understand the fear-mongering before, but I also don't ever understand, like, the fear-mongering before whatever snow or thunderstorm or whatever happens in Memphis, too. So,
Oh, no, I was going to jump in just real quick and say that I mean, the expanse of the fear, right? I mean, you know, why are you shutting down your business early in Collierville, right? You know, and Bartlett, right? You know, do you think that were the marauding blacks going to make their way out to, you know, to the Mississippi state line? I mean, you know, how exactly big did you think, right? You know, if something was going to pop off, do you think it was going to be like over a 30-mile radius, right? You know, so, I mean, you know, just the, you know, that was the part that really struck me as just really odd. And then to see the dissonance, right, about you know, everything's shutting down, people closing early, you know, you send your kids home early, you know, no after school programs and all this other kind of stuff. And then when no violence jumps off, everybody jumping on social media like, "BC, look, we did it right. You know, we love Memphis, grit and grind." Right. But yeah, but 29 hours ago, you were like, hide your women in jewelry because the blacks are coming. Right. So, you know, it was a real serious disconnect.
I think if I could add something to that, too. I know how I feel about this because we processed this yesterday when the day of the video happened on Friday. I had the worst depression I've had. I struggle with depression and anxiety. And a lot of entrepreneurs do, so that's not a new thing. A lot of teachers do. I was a teacher for 10 years. So, but I got triggered. And so, I mean, I couldn't get out of bed. And we have a monthly cipher at our coffee club, at the Anti-Gentrification Coffee Club. And, you know, we had a lot of the community artists coming out and I'm normally there to help facilitate. And I text the group chat like, guys, I might not make it today. And I got some really good encouragement from my brothers, just like, hey, you know, we're here for you. Let us know what you need. Also, what you might need is to be here with us because, you know, as we said, like, I think black people have always processed our blues by putting a rhythm to it. And like being able to be in that space, I think for me was really transformative. And the start of me starting to look at why the conversation is the way it is, I feel like before I had a chance to react, I was told not to overreact. And that makes me feel gaslit. Like I feel like I was told what my reaction was going to be. And then I was told that reaction was wrong before I had a chance to even actually react. And I have a lot of thoughts on that. But one, who are these, whoever is creating this narrative, who are they to determine what overreaction is? Like, you know what I mean? Like, how are they to determine what my reaction is and whether or not it's an overreaction, you know? And two, I feel like by saying don't overreact before I've even had a chance, like, I feel like I, you know, growing up as a kid in Ferronia Square, which is in Whitehaven, right next to Pepper Tree, you got this fear around getting punked. And I feel like somebody hit me in the face and then said, hey, chill, chill, chill. And I hadn't even had a chance to really process what just happened to me. Like, let me, I don't even have a right to feel the pain before I'm told how to deal with the pain. And that's upsetting. And I think it's done intentionally because it feels like a way to control the narrative and control the story. And like Memphians know that there isn't peace here. Not in a biblical sense. There is not shalom. There's not the presence of actual peace in our communities. That's a longstanding fact. I mean, that's why we're famous for the music we're famous for. But being told, be peaceful, when people know for a fact here, when we are honest with ourselves that we haven't experienced peace in a long time, is upsetting. And I think it's more upsetting that there was more fear around the idea of violence from Black people than there was around the fear of violence against Black people. And that's a fear that we experience every single day. All of us, for all of our kids and all of our families, deal with a debilitating fear of violence against our community, from our community and from outside of it. And we have to deal with that every day. it's upsetting that the idea that that violence might in any way be acknowledged, let alone reciprocated, created a citywide shutdown. But the reality that everyone in the city lives with is business as usual. And it's really frustrating. It's really frustrating for me. And I have sat with those emotions long enough to feel like, man, we, all of us know what the story is here, but no one took a chance to listen to that first. They told us what the story is and then told us the story was one where we were the villains. And they tricked us into thinking that not reacting and stifling our emotions and being isolated and sitting in our house at 6 p.m. and just holding our breath was success. It was framed as success because I saw people online saying, we did it. Yay, we did it. And I'm like, what we did? We got punked. That's what we did. We got punked. And we're celebrating the fact that we got punked. This is not to advocate for violence in any way, you know, and I think that's, it's sad that that even needs to be stated, but I'm saying the amount of time that I have spent in therapy, and I feel like I'm just beginning, one of the biggest things is that you have to acknowledge your emotions before you can figure out what to do with them. I have to actually say what the emotion is, and that's hard for me to do anyway, to actually sit down and identify a clear emotion. And before I even had the chance to do that, I was told what my emotion was going to be and then told that was the wrong response. And I think that that's because people are afraid of what's going to happen if we actually tell the truth about what's happening in this city. And I think that's what folks are mostly afraid of. That's what folks were afraid of with Nat Turner. That's what folks were afraid of with Gullah Jack. You know what I mean? That's what folks have always been afraid of, is Black people telling the truth about what's actually happening to us.
Yeah, and I think that we need to understand. We need to really understand that if there was rioting and looting and the whole city was burnt down on Friday, that the whole city still acted in more restraint than those police officers did. Like, regardless of how you want to look at it, we are civilians. So you can't hold civilians to one standard and hold officers to another standard. Like, that should never be the case. But oftentimes, we often find ourselves placing more responsibility on civilians than officers whose duties is to protect and serve. These are people that's getting the days. These are people that's getting the discounts and stuff like that. Like, civilians don't get discounts. Civilians don't get these benefits and whatnot. So, like, I think that at some point we do have to, like you said, acknowledge of what's right and what's wrong, and not gaslight us, because that's the biggest thing, is that we are being gaslit and we are being tricked and coerced into thinking that, like, because there were no violence, this was a good conclusion. But keep in mind that they are trying to make it seem like this is the conclusion when, like Dr. McKinney said, this is just the beginning. And we need to continue to phrase it that way, and we need to continue to look forward in that capacity so that we can move towards progress. With that being said, Dr. McKinney, this is for you specifically. Tyree Nichols was 29. You have two adult male sons. Like, how does that hit you? Like, looking at it from the perspective of somebody who does have adult male sons.
It's a great question. I think a lot about something that my father put up on Facebook in the wake of George Floyd. And the post that he put up was that when he became a father, he prayed that his son would not have any negative interaction with the cops. And that is still his prayer for his now 55-year-old son. Mm. And he went on to say, and now I have to pray that my grandsons don't have any negative interactions with the cops. Right. And so, you know, and his father told him, right. And his father prayed over him that he would not have any interactions with the cops growing up in rural Arkansas in the 1940s and 1950s. And so I think about that post all the time, because that's generations, right? That's three generations of Black men who on some way, shape or form are having to contend with the possibility, the very real possibility of police violence, right? You know, just like my dad was stressed out every time I left the house, you know, when our boys, you know, when Io and Chioke got into, you know, middle school and high school, and, you know, they both play basketball, and, you know, they both, you know, they got a big, large friend group, and, hey, Dad, can we go out and do this after the game, or can we go hang out here? Can we go hang out there? When they both got into high school and were driving and were able to, you know, hang out with their friends and stuff. And, you know, on the one hand, you want your kids to live their lives and to not be constrained by the realities in which we find ourselves. But on the other hand, you know, sitting up at night when one of them's not home yet, trying not to be terrified, right? Mm-hmm. Trying not to be scared, trying not to automatically go down the rabbit hole, right, of possibilities and whatnot. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's and so when people talk about, you know, oh, it's happened again, and talk about how this is cyclical, it's not cyclical. It's just here, right? I mean, this is just where we are. There's no ebb and flow to it, right? It's just a straight mm-hmm. line. And it's just, you know, from my father's time to my time to my son's time. That's what hurts me, right? That's the thing that makes me break down when I talk about this in extended periods of time, right? And it's back to that James Baldwin quote, right? And it's, how much more time do you need for your progress, right? You know, you've taken my father's time and my mother's time, my sister's time, my brother's time, my uncle's time. You've taken up my time. How much more time do we need for this progress? Where is this progress, right? Mm-hmm. Thinking about when you start thinking about your own kids and their friends, right? And their extended, you know, and their extended networks, when you start thinking about, you know, you can put faces to these individuals, right? You know, this brother was somebody's baby, mm-hmm. you know, and he's calling out, he's crying out to his mother. It's just so much. Right. It's just so much. It's overwhelming sometimes.
Yeah. And I think that, like, what can't be missed in this conversation is that I once listened to a podcast by a woman named Jasmine Holmes. She is a great author and whatnot. She does a lot of great stuff. A great African-American and African history studier and whatnot. She just does a lot of great work. And she talked about her husband and she's talked about how hard it is to be a socially aware Black person, Black male specifically. And I think that, like, that gets lost in the midst of this. So when you say that, like, this is not a cycle, you're right. Like, in that, like, it's so oftentimes lost. And like when Bart talks about people expecting you to react a certain way, placing the expectations on you, so on and so forth, like, that's so oftentimes the case when they don't have to carry that same weight, when they don't have the same fears of son getting home late and not trying to go down a rabbit hole, when they don't have the same fear of Brennan getting ready to have a kid. Do you have, do, 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 are you, is your wife pregnant?
Yeah, Brennan? She is.
Okay, cool. Just double checking. I was like, I think she is. Bart, all boys, right?
Three boys.
So yeah, all boys. So like when you have that, and you're in these spaces, like how it's not a cycle. And like if you don't hear anything else from this podcast, I want to make sure you hear that it's not a cycle. Like every day is a new set of challenges. Every day is another day of fighting the worst thoughts. Because you are socially aware. And where they can take you and how they can lead you. Justin, this is a question for you, as a clinician. How would you encourage somebody who's just watched that video and doesn't know how to feel? And also, how would you encourage somebody who hasn't watched the video but may want to?
You know, I think, and I'm going to go back to the old age saying, curiosity killed the cat. And I think mm-hmm. that the more we are curious about something, we try to seek out, well, what's the big deal? Why is it so bad? And then we look at this video, and then that is traumatic. Just like Dr. McKinney was saying, when you start thinking about your own kids or your own family members or even you, a lot of clinicians talk about this vicarious traumatization, which means essentially you put yourself in that person's shoes and then you empathetically think that it's you. And so that creates an emotional reaction, understandably mm-hmm. so. And so I think that by watching the video and then consuming the images around it is scary. It puts us in a place that's not good. So I always tell people to, just like I've chosen not to watch it, I know that I haven't created or had the capacity to do so. So I think mm-hmm. it's really important for people to recognize what they have the capacity for. So even if it is your job to watch it, manage what you're needing in that moment. So if you feel overwhelmed, mm-hmm. stop. If you feel sad and scared, stop. Take a moment, breathe, do something to take care of yourself. If you're going to mm-hmm. choose to watch it, it doesn't mean that you have to consume it all in one time. It also doesn't mean that you have to watch it at all. We mm-hmm. know that someone died that is a Black man at the hands of Black police. And so oftentimes I think we look at footage to figure out what the truth is, but we already know what the truth is. And mm-hmm. so I think that it's important for people to do what they can to take care of themselves. And that's going to look different in every household based on beliefs, culture, religious backgrounds, education level. It's going to look differently across the mark. So if people don't know how to feel, I think that that's where you talk to somebody that can help you shape what you're thinking. You may not know how you feel, but if you communicate with somebody, maybe they can help you, like a therapist or a coach or a friend can help mm-hmm. you identify what that feeling is. And then after that, you get to figure out what you want to do with it. So I think that that would be the emotionally intelligent, responsible way to handle it. And then sometimes you just cry. Sometimes you just cuss. Sometimes you just go to the gym. Sometimes you just say nothing. And if that's what you have the capacity for, then that's what you have.
Mm-hmm. Brennan, Breathe Brother. If I want you to put your Breathe Brother hat on. I don't know if y'all got that merch yet, but if you don't, you should. But with that being said, I want you to put the hat on, and I want you to be able to communicate the importance of journaling, and like why that may be important at a time like now. And kind of like talk a little bit about talk a little bit about your journal as well.
Yeah, so I mean, I think I personally love journaling because it's a way to process through what's in my head. A lot of times mm-hmm. I can get caught up and anxious and just feeling a lot of things because everything is just here in my head. And so putting things down gives it a space, gives it a place to be. It helps calm me because I'm now like, even if I don't have it figured out, it's no longer just inside my head. I think mm-hmm. often also like, the reason that I wrote Breathe was one, because there was not a lot of resources that were made for Black men. A lot of the resources were made for dominant culture, white men. But mm-hmm. and there were a few others on the market at that time. But I think that there's always space for more. I think mm-hmm. additionally, like I think that I personally push therapy. I personally push going to see people like Dr. Dotson. I've been sending people your contact. I'm hoping that you've been getting some more, clients.
Yeah.
But like, I think sometimes like there's so much, sometimes that takes a lot to get to that place where you enter the counselor's office. And so I think journaling is a place to start. And it's not, and like at the end of the journal, I say like, this is step one. Now go see a therapist. Like, don't stop, don't stay here. And so, yeah, man, I think that even in spaces like this, like in when you find that there is, you find yourself feeling, not knowing how you feel, you find yourself feeling a lot of things, like being able to journal, like your thoughts and your emotions can start to help you find make some sense and find some solace in what's going on.
Yeah. Bart, I didn't notice until you mentioned it today that you struggle with depression and anxiety. Thank you for mentioning that on the pod. For real, that's super helpful. How would you encourage like somebody who also may have some of the same struggles as they're dealing with this, as they're having days where they don't want to get out of bed, as they're having days where they are just trying to process it all? What kind of encouragement would you give them?
I would definitely amen everything that's been said. Like, find a therapist. Journal, music for me started out because it was the only place I had to process my emotions. You know, creating art, I think the thing I can say specifically from what we do at Coffee Black is that, like, man, maintain your rituals. Coffee is started out as, you know, almost 2,000-year-old African ritual ceremony about peace. And it's about sharing peace with neighbors, that blessing of Bunapinagea Hendabina, that Ethiopian blessing means may your house lack no coffee nor peace. And it was meant to be said as you prepare coffee, prayed as you prepare coffee, and share it when you give it to someone. And trying to create like and fight to maintain those rituals, especially in a situation where fear is being pushed so heavily, it makes you want to isolate yourself. It makes you want to give up your rituals. Even the day of the video releasing, we have a ritual of like coming together and ciphering as a community. And I find when the first thing that happens when I'm depressed is I tend to isolate myself. I tend to drop those rituals, especially the ones that involve other people. And I also find that a lot of times the one of the first steps with me coming out of a depression is engaging those rituals again, whether it be like the rituals of coming together at church with my family, a family dinner. I mean, you can think of name a bunch of them. They don't have to be coffee related, you know, but just those rituals related to our community. And I kind of think about, we had a screening of our documentary, a virtual screening, and we were speaking to this film club. And I said, I think the interesting thing about definition is that it provides borders. And the great thing about borders is that it can hold something for later. And a lot of these ephemeral values of like peace and transparency and mourning and love and expression, they're held and preserved through firm definitions that we experience as rituals or ceremonies. And it can be easy to disregard those in the world of the internet and in the world of, you know, instant gratification. But for me, I found fighting for those and fighting for myself to give myself time to experience those things allows me to access a lot of really beautiful emotions and a lot of beautiful experiences that oftentimes are hard to grasp without those firm definitions and borders. And so I would say, man, hold on to those. One, the rituals that we have as a city. One of the things that was the most beautiful to me about Friday at the coffee club was like at the end of it, one of the guys who comes to the shop, he's a regular, the younger brother. I'm proud of this man. And he's an independent artist. And his name is Austin. And he was playing some new music as we were getting ready to head out the door. And if y'all familiar with Getting Sturdy, like it's like this New Jersey style of dancing. Mm-hmm. But the song started out like with a classic Memphis beat. And like the whole room started juking, you know what I mean? And then it transitioned into like one of these Jersey beats and people started getting sturdy. And that was such a beautiful moment to me to hold on to an emotion that like the situation surrounding Tyree makes hard to access. Like it's hard to find a way to hold on to a feeling of joy, or especially like unmitigated, almost rebellious joy that you feel with Memphis music. You know what I mean? Almost like, I wish you would come and take this from me kind of joy. And embodying that in community with people with traditional dances and traditional music and, you know, things that have a long history of like significance within my memory, my cultural memory, my personal memory, was powerful because it provided access to those feelings in a way that like just thinking about the feeling couldn't do. You know what I mean? I had to be within the boundaries of that ceremony, that situation, that circumstance, that ritual. And I would encourage people to fight to maintain those things. Like, don't skip out on dinner with grandma. Like, don't skip out on gathering for Bible study. Don't skip out on going to the barbershop. Like, we need those rituals because those are places for us to, like, preserve and fight and hold on to the things that we need to make it through this moment as a city. So I would say if you're dealing with depression, like, listen to your loved ones. Allow yourself to be swept up in, like, the rituals and the traditions that we've built out. Even going to the gym, like I've been going to the gym really hard for the last couple of weeks. And, you know, my wife was telling me like, hey, let's go, you know, and it took a lot of fight for me to get out the bed and go. But we went. Fortunately, everything was closing early. And so to your point, Dr. Dotson, like a lot of the closing of our institutions made it difficult for us to access the things that we need that are wrapped up in the traditions and ceremonies found within them. So turn the light back on. I would definitely say, Marius, no, sir. Turn the light back on. I would definitely say, like, man, fighting for those traditions, fighting for those rituals, and that those things that we experience in community are really important. You know, don't sacrifice them in exchange for the comfort that we might feel from reacting to the fear mongering that's going on right now by isolating ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Dr. McKinney, any closing thoughts you got? And also, if somebody's hearing this and they want to know more, what resources can you think of that you would recommend somebody to maybe read, watch, listen to, anything like that may be helpful in getting a greater understanding of the gray area that is race in America and also police brutality in the city of Memphis?
I would recommend that people subscribe to MLK50, Wendy Thomas's online newspaper, which is dedicated to racial equality and social justice. It is an amazing venue, and they should pull it up and go read it at the anti-gentrification. So that's what they should do. They should read, which I love, by the way. I love that shop. It just makes me feel better every time I step in it. So I'm so glad y'all are doing what you do. So happy y'all are here. I always tell people to read James Baldwin, read Baldwin's Fire Next Time. He talks very eloquently, for instance, about black cops. And he talks about how it always seemed to him that the black cops were more violent and more aggressive because they're trying to impress the white cops who are with them. Right. Again, back to, you know, the way white supremacy sort of works. Right. And then for Memphis, there's a bunch of really rich texts out here that we could pull up. Shameless plug, An Unseen Light, Black Struggles for Freedom in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm one of the co-editors of that book, along with Aram Goodsusian. Again, it's called An Unseen Light, and it's the history of the Black struggle for freedom from Reconstruction to the Black Lives Matter moment, to the early 2020s. So pick that up and check that out. But I would hardly recommend Wendy Thomas's MLK50. Newspaper, because that's a great place to start to read about race, power, and justice, but also to read about Memphis.
And big shout out to Wendy Thomas, man. I think the MLK 50 just got a $2 million grant from the Ford Foundation. If I remember correctly, I think that was like announced last week. They got a $2 million grant. So like,
that's right.
So big shout out to them for big shout out to them for doing the work that they're doing, and big shout out to the Ford Foundation. Not to be confused with the actual car. Not that Ford. But like, big shout out to the Ford Foundation for allowing them to be able to continue to do what they're doing. Already, like, that's major. I know that just so everybody knows, like, everybody who's on this call was asked to be on this call 24 hours or less ago. So like, it's a big commitment for them to be able to jump on this call so quickly. I think Dr. Dotson said he's usually asleep, or well on his way to sleep. I know he's well on his way to sleep, but we do really appreciate all y'all, man. Dr. Dotson, man, you're doing great stuff. I've known you since like University of Memphis PhD program. Brennan, you, like, the work that you're doing and the international success you've had and the success you're continuing to have is huge. And it's cool to see. It's cool to see like where you're going. And I'm super excited, like, as a counselor myself, I'm super excited that you're also going to be a counselor. Bart, man, I've told you this story privately, but I want to say it publicly. Anti-gentrification Coffee Club is doing great things. I was at work the other day, and it was a young dude who's at my job, and he was talking about the first time he stepped foot in Anti-Gentrification Coffee Club. He said it made him want to cry because of how unapologetically Black it was. Like, his words, not mine. He said it made him want to cry. And he has gone back ever since. And I even see him rocking the Coffee Black hoodies every time I see him, the orange one. So like, he's in there. He's fully invested. Dr. McKinney, man, to me, you a legend. If you don't follow this man on Twitter, you need to. This man got the best tweets out there. You can tell that well thought out, and he was doing it before they extended the character limit. So this man, he been real with it. And shout out to your sons, Io. Shout out to Chioke, man. He got one son who is at school in New Orleans and another son at Howard, and they are both doing their thing right now. So like, you got a daughter as well. I don't know her, but I know you got a daughter as well. So shout out to her too. But with that being said, man, I'm super, super excited for y'all to just join us today and just really support us in this capacity. Ryan, we miss you. But I do think that, like, to wrap it up, a verse that God put on my heart to start the year was from Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians. And for those who don't know, this is a book that Paul wrote after a series of unexpected deaths in the church. So a lot of people had died in the church, and that's what led for Paul to write this book. And what he ended up writing in this book was, it basically said, man, this is what he told them after like a series of unexpected deaths. He said, rejoice always, pray without ceasing, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. So like, in that, continue to rejoice, continue to give praise, continue to give thanks, and continue, if you are a Christian, continue to pray, and do that, like, so that you can still go on. And I think the point of that is that you can go on from what's going on, that you won't be hampered by this. In the same way Bart's wife asked him to go to the gym to make sure that he could be back in a good mind state, like, this is the same mentality. So like, in that, like, do that. And by the way, that is 1 Thessalonians 5, I believe 16-18. 16-18. So like, in that, like, don't let up on those things. Continue to rejoice. Continue to give thanks. Continue to be thankful. Continue to be encouraged by those around you. And like Bart said, like, continue to be in the community that God's placed you in, or try to stretch your community to where you need it to be. Because a lot of people are not in community right now. And isolation is the worst thing you can have right now during times of distress. So be mindful of that. This episode is going to be on YouTube. So if you are on YouTube, then check it out. It's best to watch on YouTube. But at this point, if you listen on the podcast, I don't know what to tell you, man. I already told you at the beginning of the episode. So that is where it is, man. But with that being said, man, we really do appreciate y'all rocking with us for this long. We hope that this conversation has been encouraging for you. For Uncle Form Podcast, man, my name is Darius Watkins, and we are out.